I just think it's really, really important for people to understand that there are no safe and legal routes for refugees to come to this country. This is the only way they can come here. It's on a boat to pay. Yeah, they've got the whole of Europe. Why should we put that burden on the rest of Europe?
But we still
have to take responsibility for the fact that we have a lot of stakes in the conflicts and the climate crisis that causes people to be refugees and have to come to another country. They're not choosing to leave their country, at their home, their children, their parents.
Our fucking children, you shouldn't count. Of our children, of this fucking race, you shouldn't count. Fuck off.
Hello, and welcome to the Jolly Heretic. I have a very special guest for you today, and that is the independent journalist Jack Hadfield, who was filming at the migrant hotel protests yesterday. That's the 22nd of July in Canary Wharf at the Britannia Hotel. And he captured, in my view, one of the most fascinating, one of the most visceral, one of the most uniquely representative of the left pieces of footage I have ever seen, which has gone viral. And so, which is the one where basically Deirdre Barlow gets confronted by an Essex man. And I want to talk to him about it. So, Jack, hello.
Hello. Great to be on with you.
Okay, so tell me, I'm going to put the footage in as part of my video, if that's okay. So tell me what it was exactly that happened yesterday that you managed to capture so well.
Yeah, so I was at the Britannia Hotel in Canary Wharf yesterday afternoon and evening, where there was this protest that started because they turned this, you know, four-star hotel in Canary Wharf, you know, the banking capital of the country, into a place where there was going to dump a load of asylum seekers from goodness knows where. So a bunch of patriots and locals turned out to actually protest outside the hotel. And then at some point, about six or seven counter-protesters turned up. And they did not receive a nice welcome, to put it mildly. I believe the woman you mentioned was Nathalie Bienfe, who is a local Green councillor from Bow, I believe, who made her way down.
Hang on a minute. No, from Groningen in the Netherlands. That's where she's from, via Bow, but she's from Groningen. And I could tell, I was listening to her, and I knew she was Dutch because I was at university there, and I knew she was Dutch. And the way she said, excuse me, that's what a Dutch person would say. But anyway, carry on. Yes, they made their way down.
Yes. So she made her way down over there and started going on about how, you know, oh, there's the climate crisis. We just have to take these people in. Oh, it's not fair to all the other European countries that we don't take our fair share. And, oh, we've got to be gentle and care and all the, you know, standard nonsense that these guys come out with. And then, you know, that she was getting, you know, questioned by a bunch of people, including myself. And then, you know, at one point, one guy just comes out and shouts at her and calls her, you know, frankly, just asks, what about our children, C-word? And just the look on her face, just the pure look on her face of clearly never been confronted by this. She's clearly a person who is the type of person to go to stand up to racism, Antifa protests on the regular, you know, wave their placards and, you know, talk to all the lefty friends over a nice matcha latte or whatever, and have no idea what the other side looks like or even what any of their arguments are. So just coming up face to face of, you know, as I said, some like Essex or Cockney geezer who just straight up basically told her to piss off in ruder terms than that, was just so satisfying to watch unfold live.
And what happened after that?
Well, so at that point, I then started grilling her, asking her, you know, if she understood that, you know, asylum seekers and Afghanis, for example, were so much more likely to commit rapes and sexual assaults. And, you know, whether she'd even, you know, consider how much money that these people had to come here. You know, they're not the poor and desperate and yearning of the world. And just in the middle of that, while she was replying to me, they got bundled off by the police just round the corner at first. And then about 15 minutes later, they were fully pushed down the road, supposedly escorted away for their own safety by the cops.
And did you talk only to her, or did you talk? There was some sort of trans woman behind her called Phoebe, who's also a Green councillor. Did you talk to him or anybody else?
No. Just Natalie. You know, they really weren't there in front of the hotel for very long. I would say I caught them in two clips, about 3 minutes total. That's about the amount of time that they were being confronted by the protesters. Maybe a minute just before I started filming. But there wasn't. It was a very short interaction between the two before, until again the police quickly bundled them away.
So why do you think that it's got so much, that clip has got so much leverage, that it's excited people so much, that it's been shared so much on Twitter? What do you think it is about it? About the first clip, I mean, the clip where she's told to fuck off.
I think it's just so, it plays into the stereotype so well. You know, she looks exactly like the, privately educated, upper middle class London elite, libtard who has all of these opinions and never, ever, ever is challenged on any of them. And then versus, just the working class, the guys worried about their wives and kids, just telling her to piss off. And it was that, dynamic of, just normal, salt of the earth people confronting the, London elites. And then just her her face really was a picture just afterwards. It was that and also the bird hands that she was doing, which is apparently quite stereotypical of them as well.
Yes, okay. Yes, I don't know about these bird hands. It's interesting, though, that we, as English people, have projected a great deal onto her. But as I say, she's not English. She's Dutch. So she won't have been to private school. Because in the Netherlands, people don't go to private school unless they're mentally retarded or something. She's from Groningen, which is an overwhelmingly white area of the Netherlands. But I was thinking about it myself. It's like she's middle class. This guy's working class, full on Essex geezer. I imagine she's never been hit. She may even never have been shouted at. She probably had to go on the naughty step. She's been surrounded by high status people, and she's adopted high status beliefs because that's what you do. And maybe she's a little bit socially anxious, and so she thinks, yeah, she'd better adopt these high status beliefs or she won't have friends. And what I thought was interesting was when she started speaking, did you notice this? When she started her little rant, which I felt was something scripted almost, it was something that she'd learned, there was a gleam in her eyes. She knew she had power. She was going to enjoy this. She was going to show how civil and reasonable and good she was. And people were going to say, Natalie, what a hoot. What a good kind of bent. And this was, well, did you notice that little gleam? Mm. It was the gleam to the utter shock.
Yeah, exactly. You know, she started off, owning the chuds with her lovely, pre-written script, which I'm sure she was expected that somebody would get it on camera and, oh, look at how brave and impressive she was going to confront the racists at their own protest, standing up for migrants, standing up for this, that, and the other. And as soon as she started going off script, like when I challenged her, when other people challenged her, when obviously that guy, challenged her, she just malfunctioned and goes, this isn't the way this is supposed to happen. These people aren't meant to fight back. They're just meant to be silent and let me tell them how good I am and how terrible they are and how they need to come around to our way of thinking. Otherwise they'll never be part of us, the good people.
Yes, and I noticed that she, The reaction was incredibly visceral. This was very interesting. So you'll note that I really wanted to sort of dissect this, and so do other people. She's so unexpected. She's so not expecting it. She's so never experienced anything like it. She immediately holds her heart. So okay, you could argue that's performative, but on the other hand, I think perhaps her heart is suddenly beating. She's suddenly alive. in a dangerous situation for the first time in her life. And I noticed that, as I've lived in the Netherlands, I've noticed that her English broke down as well. So that phrase, excuse me? No, she, excuse me. That's what she said. Excuse me. And that's what you'd, as to believe, that's exactly what you'd say. And an English person wouldn't do that. They wouldn't say that then. And that's when I thought, yeah, she's Dutch, I think. I can just about hear it. So it was like, it was, as you say, she malfunctioned from this reassured person speaking perfect English with, to some extent, an English accent to just crashing. And then she sort of almost, she looks to the side. Are they backing me? Are my friends backing me? And the transsexual counsellor sort of was smirking a little bit, which was interesting. And then she sort of, like this sort of is almost shaking, and it's amazing. I wonder had she ever experienced it's a clash of social classes, of a class that says you're conscientious, you follow the rules, you don't express emotion, everything is formal, everything's a script. I bet even if she went on the naughty step, she was then told, okay, you have to formally apologize for being a naughty girl. To being alive and in the moment and subject to danger and subject to just the unpredictable. Is this a problem, do you think, that we have a clash of social classes that divides along those lines?
Yeah, I think that certainly adds to it. And yeah, as you said, you know, she was forced to default to factory settings, you know, and the Dutch came out, she was, you know, fully shocked by it, like a big amount of, you know, metaphorical water was thrown directly onto her. She started sparking out. So yeah, there definitely is this social class problem. And, you know, you can see it in terms of how the social classes interact with people of different politics. And to be fair, this applies to London a lot as well. There was, I believe, back at the time, you know, looking back at Brexit, there was a stat where most Remainers, their only friends were Remainers, whereas people who were for Leave had friends on both sides of the camp. And this seems to be the case. Obviously, you know, this obviously now things are a lot more complicated than Brexit, obviously. But just as an illustration for the liberal or conservative or, you know, woke, anti-woke, whichever side you want to put it on, the left has always been far more insular. You know, you can live your life as somebody in London, as somebody who went to a good school, votes now Lib Dem, Labour or Green, and you can literally, in your social sphere, never encounter someone who is open about being on the right. Maybe like a wet centre-right, you know, really rich Tory type who's like, oh, I'm economically conservative but socially liberal, whatever, you know, whose dad's got billions or something. But you know, you'll never encounter people with different views. Whereas, especially if you're in the working class now, you know, you're far more likely to see that, and especially, you know, further more outside of London. So it's a problem of the specific class demographic where they just never have to be confronted with any different ideas or people who think differently to them in any way, shape, or form, literally ever.
Why do you think that? Why do you think that happens? That it's one way, right? That conservatives are able to get to know people that are left wing, but not the other way around.
Well, it's because, you know, I think that you always had the phenomenon of, you know, they used to call it shy Tories, in terms of people who were, you know, would say and believe one thing, but when they get into the safety of the ballot box, they can finally tick the X for the nasty party, you know, and nobody will crash out at them. You know, I think that's the middle class, I think overall, has a lot more political social rigidity within it, in terms of, you know, if you don't believe, you know, what we believe, you know, like, you're not coming round to our, you know, high tea tomorrow, whatever. Whereas, you know, I think the working classes generally, there is a different way in terms of how they operate. And I guess, like, I suppose the other thing is there's, you know, for people who are, who enjoy, you know, discussing and talking, you know, having debates about politics or whatever, who like to get in touch, like, with the news in the traditional sense of things. You like to talk about it round the dinner table. know, this is more necessarily of a middle class idea where, you know, you don't have to be worried about, you know, where the next meal's coming from. So you can spend a bunch of your time just sort of, what's the economy doing? What's the Chancellor doing this week? You know, that kind of attitude where having politics as sort of as fun and being a hobby is very sort of middle class of it. And so that it becomes more of this social game rather than having any real discussions about anything meaningful. It's all about social signaling for them.
So by implication, essentially, left-wing people are more neurotic and feel negative feelings more strongly and are more likely to shun you and so forth if you're not left-wing. And so this forces right-wing people to keep their heads down and shut up and not confront them. And so consequently, they become more insular for that reason, whereas the left-wing will confront the right because they're more neurotic and feel negative feelings more strongly. I think that's how I would psychologically see that. Going back to another thing you said... you talked about fair share and, you know, people coming across the water. Speaking of water, it struck me on some level that she was almost excited by being confronted in that way. It was like she was aroused. It was like she'd always wanted Daddy to set her boundaries and tell her what to do and so on, and it had never ever happened. And suddenly, so she's just been this naughty girl all her life, and suddenly she's been confronted by masculinity, like real masculinity, by someone that is not going to do but could do violence, and she quite likes it, which is consistent with studies that indicate that feminist identification is associated with sadomasochism. I wonder if she was. If she was excited and thus shocked by her own excitement, shocked by the fact that she, strong woman, actually quite liked the dominance that was expressed to her.
Well, I mean, I think there could be something about the general rebellion. I mean, you often see this from people who are, you know, supposedly, you know, rebelling against their conservative parents by going the most left wing that they possibly can, you know, because they want to tell, you know, Daddy to go away, and they're, you know, standing up and putting their arms and finally stamping their feet down. But I do think a lot of people as well, you know, do actually, even if they express, you know, sort of a desire to be a, you know, lefty lib, you know, sometimes they do want to live in a society with authority where they are told what to do. You know, some people are extremely more independent, free-minded, and that will just, you know, anger them if they're being put on a leash. But you know, some people do have the instincts to be led. Some people are leaders, and you know, and some people follow. And I think if you've acted as if you're a leader, but your main instinct is to follow, and you know, you finally get confronted by someone who's, you know, confronting your leadership in that way, then there might be some part of you that thinks, oh, I actually don't mind this, you know.
Do you think that really she is a red in the streets but a fascist in the sheets?
I mean, there always is the joke of that meme where it's like where you have the woman being like, oh, you know, have you read this this recent Guardian article? And then her boyfriend is the most racist man alive. So that definitely is a real phenomenon. But you know, I think with her, and I think people who have fully taken the Kool-Aid, you know, where they're like the green councillors, I think it's probably a hell of a lot more subconscious than that, at least for now.
How is it subconscious? Well, that's the point, though. If it is subconscious, yeah, then that's when you get these visceral reactions, these breakthroughs. Mm.
I don't think that she's going to be a fash any day soon, for example. But you know, maybe over the course of the time, she will come round from the communist mind breaking thinking and perhaps become a normal person. You know, it's entirely possible.
But your video cuts out, just it finishes just after the incident occurs when she's confronted. I mean, how long did it take her to get back down to a baseline, back to herself?
Well, the next clip that I put on where I confront her directly and then she's led away by the police is pretty much about 2 or 3 seconds after that clip ends. So I think she had about sort of a 5 second pause of just going, whoa, what on earth just happened to me? And then sort of pulled it back together. But she, you know, you can see in the second clip that I posted, and again, as more people start to confront her, you know, her pre-written script really starts to break down, and she starts to become, I think, quite a lot less sure of herself.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So can you tell me a bit of background? So how did you cross the line? I don't know, like, where are you from? How did you cross the line into being a bit of an agent provocateur? What happened in your life?
Well, I've been doing this for 10 years now. I started at Breitbart way back in the day, writing for them. Then I graduated university. I moved to write for more American
publications. Where did you go to university?
Warwick.
Warwick. I went to a conference there last year, the WITAM, at Warwick University.
Oh, yes.
And it was very, very woke. It was reported in the Warwick Boar that there'd been this secret far-right conference about with books for sale, like Woke Eugenics, which is one of mine, and Carl Sagan of Akkad and whatever. So was Warwick University 10 years ago, presumably you were there, was that basically a uniformly woke environment, or were there little secret-based groups?
Well, I mean, I was in the Conservative Association there at Warwick for a while, and it was relatively wet, but there are a few friends that were, you know, based. It definitely started to become more based after I left. But then obviously they had a scandal last year where somebody played Erica at the chairman's dinner, and it all kind of went a bit national news on that. So I think the Conservative Society is basically no longer a thing. But, you know, there were definitely, you know, based people there in my day who I was friends with. But also it still was a lot more open. It started in terms of people being friends cross-politically. Like, I was part of the Politics Society, and, you know, there were, like, communists, libs, all sorts, and, you know, we would always get drinking and take the piss out of each other together. You know, there was even one point where, you know, the Labour and Conservative societies would only a couple of years ago would do joint, you know, drinking things. But that sort of became really in sort of like 2017, 2018, to the later and, you know, to the later time of my time at Warwick, that it started. That's when it started to become, oh, no, you know, those on the right and those on the left are no longer as like chummy with each other. And it was really driven by the left. You know, there were people at university who, you know, I got hope not hated at the time. And there were lots of people who then just immediately stopped being friends with me. You know, one person who I was friends with, you know, pulled me out of a lecture to just bollock me in the hallway for about 10 minutes.
Bollock you in the hallway?
Mm.
For what?
Being, you know, a far right racist or whatever, which is what, you know, hope not hate got me for, you know, running a free speech Facebook group.
So when did you say it turned? When did it turn? About Brexit time, did it turn then? Is that when it turned?
Yeah, a little bit after Brexit. So I'd say, yeah, so post-Brexit, May 1, May 2, when you started to have the feelings in terms of where, you know, there would be less sort of bipartisanship, less making friends across politics. And I think after I left university, from my friends who were a little bit younger than me, who stayed there, like, you know, they said the atmosphere only became more objectively partisan since then.
I suppose it's so, higher. Because, I mean, before Trump, yes. Before Brexit and before Trump, if you were right wing, then you were sort of just a harmless eccentric. And oh, poor dear, he's so naive. Forgive him, Lord. He knows not what he does. But then afterwards, these slightly narcissistic people were being challenged, essentially. They were being enraged by a loss of power. And so then it was suddenly serious in terms of their status and so on. I mean, when I in the year 2000, when I or 2001, when I was at university, I went out with this Jewish girl, she was a subscriber to Searchlight, and she'd call me, you know, fascist, Nazi, whatever, but we were kind of semi an item, and it didn't matter. But that was 24 years ago. And there's no way that would be possible. In fact, one of my best friends at university was the head of Young Labour. We lived together. And it would be impossible. Because of the, I think that is the turning point, because they fear losing the thing that gives them status. Anyway, do carry on.
I think that's an entirely accurate analysis. You know, it became real. It went from, you know, politics is a game. Oh, who's in power now? Is it David Cameron or Gordon Brown? And what interest rates are they going to set this year? Are they going to bring in, you know, 100,000 migrants or 150,000 migrants? You know, all of these things where politics was just, you know, everything was so close together, you know, back then compared to how it was now. You know, I don't think the Overton window has necessarily drifted one way or the other. I think the Overton window is split in two, you know, and now there is no center. You either are on the left or the right, and there doesn't seem to be any crossover, and they're drifting further and further away and apart. It is now, you know, they're worried that we're coming for their power, for their, cultural clout, I guess, and it's now becoming real. So,
I mean, I'm pally with friendly behind the scenes with the kind of purple pilled. You know what I mean? Purple pilled, not red pilled, not blue pilled, but purple pilled elements of the right, i.e., the Daily Skeptic and indeed GB News. But they won't have me on because I'm too far right. I talk about race and so forth. But I know eventually that will change, because it used to be that such people wouldn't even speak to me at all. So it's like, even informally. So it's as you say, it's polar. There are groups that now have me on that 5 years ago would not have had me on because I was considered too out there, too extreme, too. Now they regularly have me on. So it's extraordinary. As you say, the breaking up, which I suppose, yeah, then feeds into the fact that although wouldn't that mean that the far right, would the right, or whatever you want to call it, would be more likely to become like the left, would more likely to become insular. I get the impression that every right-wing person in London under the age of about 30 knows every other right-wing person under the age of about 30, and they're all shagging each other.
Yeah, that sounds fairly true, but in fairness, that's just kind of, you know, how London politics and how it's been for forever. So I think that's more of a feature of everybody living in the same place, most of them, and being in the same social circles than anything specifically of the politics overall. But yeah, it really is incredible just how things have changed. I think even, not even the last 5 years, I think even in the last two or three years perhaps, there has been such a radical change in the discourse. If you look at people talking about, openly talking about demographic replacement, for example, you know, mass deportations now becoming things that literally that MPs are calling for, remigration, you know, as Rupert Lowe obviously is advocating, you know, like you have a third party, you know, reform whose main thing is being anti-immigration, probably going to take a majority right now in the next election. It's gone so far, so fast. And I think that's what we've also seen as well. We're seeing, you know, not just, you know, a moving, you know, to right the or left of the open window, or it's splitting, as I said. We're seeing it speed up. It's the rate of change itself is accelerating, I think.
Well, yeah, presumably. I mean, there's experimental stuff on this, that when you reach a tipping point, so you give a group of people and a couple of the people among the subjects in on it, and you say, you know, which is the biggest shape, this shape or this shape, and they all say it's shape A, and then eventually someone says it's shape B, and then someone else says it's shape B, and they're in on it. And then once it's 20% that's saying it's shape B that's bigger, even though it objectively isn't, then everybody moves over and starts saying it's shape B. And this is tipping point effect, which I think may have happened, that you reach this tipping point. And when you feel backed up as well, when you feel, if I go back to when I started my channel 2018, 2019, I was much more careful what I said, because I knew there were far fewer people that would back me up, far fewer people that were on my side, and then I got debanked and all kinds of things. And now I'm aware that this is not going to happen. We're through that. We're through that, because people have had it's very satisfying. And it, again, going back to your video, what was so extraordinary about it was her, she's used to a situation where you don't dare criticize her because you won't be backed up. No one will back you up. That man, that geezer, that bloke, that geezer, who I reckon is a fucking ledge, which means legend. Will, you seem quite middle class, so I don't know if you'd know that. But he wouldn't dare do that. But now it's that's another thing, that the anger, the need to have self-control and even bother to be scared about what the anti-racists say about you, I think has lessened. And it's probably always been lower if you're working class, because you're probably not part of the kind of job where you could lose your job for your opinions. You know, you're not part of a job like where you have some committee of ethics that will ban you if you're a barrister or something like that. You know, you can just say what you, that's why they're so dangerous in a sense, isn't it? That they can, they've never been able to, I don't know, if you do, it vox pops with people in the street. If they're middle class, they're always going to say to you, oh, which channel are you from? And what's your name? And whereas if it's working class, they don't care. They'll just talk to you. In fact, they'll come up to you and voluntarily talk to you if you have a camera. So I think that's the danger, isn't it?
No, agreed.
They're not restricted. Yes.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes obviously being at these protests, you know, sometimes get people asking, you know, if your mainstream media just so you know that you won't be stitched up. But yeah, there definitely is, you know, something about just as we've gone on, as I said, it really is just impressive at how quickly this has all changed. I'm just looking, you know, I think as well, you know, the being fired from jobs and so on. I think we are definitely far away now from what I would call, you know, peak cancellation, which I would say would be around 2017, 2018, you know, where somebody says literally one thing, it says like one slightly off color tweet, and then, you know, the entire mob goes for them. They're fired from their job. Everybody's condemned. You know, when was the last time you saw somebody get seriously, quote unquote, canceled now? For me, it's been a while, and I think partially some of that is down to, you know, one of the main cancellation areas was Twitter. And obviously since Elon's taken it over and made it X, that it's no longer the controlled left-wing playground as it was, where they could completely drum up the entire site into a 15 minutes of hate against one targeted individual who said something, you know, about, you know, race or immigration or whatever, or even something even less than that, just a slightly semi-off-color joke. You know, that no longer exists. And I think the power to whip up mobs, Twitter really was the place for that. You know, obviously you have Blue Sky, but they're all, you know, infighting over there and going mental. You know, once you break these institutions, these institutional powers away from them, you know, like, you can just see how fast things change as a result.
Well, they've been demoralized. I think they've been demoralized. And if you are psychologically that kind of person that is insecure and so forth, and thus has to deal with it by telling yourself you're morally superior, that kind of person, there's so many of them in Dickens. You're a bully, really. You're not used to being stood up to. You're not used to things not going your way. And when it does happen, often you just retreat. You just kind of collapse. There's not that you don't have the balls to you don't have the you haven't learnt the fortitude. Often via unpleasant things happening to you. Which teach you survival skills and mechanisms to cope. You haven't been taught that. You don't know how to cope. And so you just kind of collapse. And she did so, this Natalie woman, for a few seconds, but then was able to kind of right herself before being confronted with you. And then was taken away. But if it had been, I think that's it. They lost Twitter. They lost the election, and Trump wasn't going to mess around a second time. Although now he's being silly about Epstein. So they're seriously shaken up, and we know we can win. What do you think is going to happen? I take it you did a politics degree from some of the things you said. Did you do politics at Warwick?
I did. Yes.
Okay. So what do you augur is going to develop out of this? So last summer we had the riots over Keir Starmer, now we over the Woodward Cabana, now we have this. What do you think is going to develop from this? What do you prognosticate over the next couple of years?
You know, it's interesting. So I was at the Southport riots as well, and the atmosphere there felt very, very different to the atmosphere in Epping, of where I was on Sunday. It was far more Southport for me. Being there was a far more like immediate flashpoint, obviously of something a lot more serious than the, you know, sexual assault that happened in Epping, the murder of multiple young girls. And that felt like, there hadn't been, this energy expressed yet before. There's this energy of, this fire in the air of just pure rage, at the system, at the, at actual Rudy Cabana, at everybody that allowed this to happen, and, and for there to be, blood on the streets of Southport. So people just clearly, I think, went completely nuts about it, and obviously started, attacking the police and mosques and, fires and all of that all over the place. Because, they definitely felt like that wasn't a vehicle or any way of doing this. It was pure spontaneity. Whereas what I saw in Epping was something more controlled and more that had people that, it's people who'd seen what had happened last summer. And it wasn't just, people who wanted to smash something up. It was a hell of a lot more what I'd say normal, broad spectrum, and people who, weren't necessarily, against, shouting at the police or, having a bit of a Barney here and there, but weren't rioting. They were here. They were like strongly protesting in a way of that it felt calmer. And as if they felt that, it wasn't just this flashpoint. It was something that's going to build and build and build. And I think that's what we're going to see now, in that Southport, you had a week or two, it kind of flashpoint and then it fizzled out and went down. I think we're far more likely to see these protests, maybe not continue directly from Epping, but I think soon, if this doesn't continue and spark on, there'll be another one perhaps in a few months that'll then continue it. It'll last longer after that. And I think if we're not going to get into continuous protests, I think there's a point soon at which we will, where the protests after one thing spread and last longer and longer each time. So that's more of my prediction. I think that protests will become far more endemic to Britain.
And isn't it a danger that in a sense the authorities have shown weakness? They have moved some or all of the fake refugees from the Bell Hotel in Epping to this place in Canary Wharf. It's obvious, they haven't admitted that's what they've done, but it's obvious that's what they've done. And isn't that showing you basically protest works, semi-violent action works, rioting works, and we are fearful, and so we are going to move these people somewhere else that's more difficult to get to because it's in the middle of London, it's more surrounded by cameras, I don't know, whatever the thinking is. It's more secure. And so, but then in doing so, they are showing weakness in the face of the mob, which simply emboldens the mob.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I don't think that there's any way for the state to win on this. I think you're right. And with the mob becoming emboldened, like you can see that this is how the police have operated for ages, that they would have community support. They would talk to communities. This is why the rape gang's allowed to happen. These people were terrified of the Muslims communities in the north who were doing this. So I think until the police and the state overall becomes scared of, English people, standing up for themselves, nothing's going to happen. But I think they are starting to become worried, concerned, scared about what we will do. If they don't, well, probably deport most of these supposed asylum seekers who are here.
Yes, that's what's evidenced. And also, as you said, the two-tier policing is extraordinary, and the lying. And this makes so they lied and said we didn't escort these stand-up to racism, stand-up protesters from Epping Station. And then it's proven that they did, and then they back down. Okay, yeah, we did, but it's our duty to permit and assist counter protests. To which you then say, okay, were you assisting counter protests by the BNP back in the day? Were you or by English Defence League? Were you assisting that? Were you escorting them? No. So they're rubbing in the face that they can't be trusted. That they're arms of the state, or that they're arms of the sort of left-wing deep state, which then undermines confidence in the police and trust in the police. And it sort of then snowballs to a situation where the police are kind of the enemy, which is what you get in totalitarian states.
Yeah, and agreed. And I certainly think that, you know, the actions of the police have not been positive from those of us coming from the right. You know, again, you know, escorting these people, you know, from Epping Station to the Bell Hotel, It's quite a walk. It was about a 20-minute walk, you know, when I was there on Sunday. So a fair enough distance. And they went around, you know, through the middle of town. Also, there is no God-given right to have a counter-protest to a protest happen in the exact same place as the protest. There is no reason that the police couldn't have said, okay, the protest against the Bell Hotel is happening outside the Bell Hotel. There are stand-up to racism protesters who have come here. We can put the stand-up to racism protests in the middle of town, a 20-minute walk away. There is no need or right for them to come up and be face-to-face with the other side. And as we all know, every time that happens, you get conflict. Whether it's on the scale of, you know, me and Natalie Bianfe and the base Essex Cockney guy just yesterday, or whether it's in the scale, you know, of full, you know, street battles, which obviously can happen if both sides get too inflamed. Again, the actions of the police are at the very least two-tier policing, and at the very worst, they're deliberately trying to agitate those on the right to make everybody look bad, or even at the very worst, you know, get people who are concerned standing up for women and girls, you know, assaulted by Antifa or the like,
who are wearing masks, doing actions like this and this, and really it's ridiculous. The police put out a press release yesterday, the Essex Police, saying that the week of protests or whatever had cost £100,000. But you caused that. You caused the cost by bringing in these Antifa types. I mean, there wouldn't have been any cost. You wouldn't have done anything to police if you hadn't done that. I think you might be right about that. I mean, where do these people come from? How do they? There's a protest happening in Epping. How is it they managed to come from all over the place, from Walthamstow, from wherever, with placards professionally made at the drop of a hat on a weekday? I don't understand. I mean, are they like firemen? Are they kind of in reserve, paid by the government to be brought out in case there's a metaphorical racism fire that needs to be put out or something?
Well, I mean, obviously, I think, you know, well, there's two options here. Either, you know, they are directly employed by the states to put out the racism fire, as you say, or they literally have no job and no life, and this is the entire thing that gets them out of bed in the morning. But overall on this, you know, on the point of, you know, this kind of, you know, leftist outside counter protesters, you know, the left have been doing this for ages. You know, like I used to live in Manchester and I was just back up there recently, you know, and you know, and you would see signs, you know, posted outside wherever on lampposts saying that, like, oh, you know, there's a rally in London and we've got a coach, and, you know, meet outside Manchester coach station at, you know, 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, and we'll bus you all down to the middle of London to join everybody else. The left absolutely does, you know, Socialist Workers' Party, all these people stand up to racism regularly, and they clearly have the funds to do this, literally regularly bus people in from other areas of the country to wherever they need them to protest. I don't necessarily think this is what happened in Epping with the counter protesters there, because, you know, you could pretty easily just get on the tube, you know, as did I. But these people are definitely far more organized and far more willing to bring in people from further afield, not just people turning up from outside because they want to and they want to come and support people, but a deliberate organization of that.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. So if people want to find you online and so forth and support you, where can they find you?
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter, X. I'm at Jack Hadders. That's Jack, H-A-D-D-E-R-S. You can find me there. And all my other links are on my website, my Linktree, which is jackhadfield.co.uk.
Okay, thank you very much, chaps. And if you haven't watched that video that he took, that Jack took, go and watch it. It's really is fascinating stuff. Okay, I will see you soon, chaps, and goodbye!
Are you ready for the future of the West?